Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And from Granite State College, offering diverse bachelor's and graduate business degree programs online. Designed to help working adults advance, Granite State College, where quality matters. More information and registration at granite.edu.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. GOP negotiators reach a deal on a state budget, but can it go all the way when it hits the House floor? Keno-funded full-day kindergarten looks like a go, but not everyone thinks it goes far enough. The plan to tighten water standards when it comes to PFCs, meanwhile, dies. Governor Sununu says New Hampshire's congressional delegation is failing to serve the state's interests in Washington, and more bears. Some are crashing Bike Week. Others are showing up as invited guests of a well-known artist. Lots to mull this week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I am Josh Rogers, joined this week by Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union leader, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, and Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor. Lots to talk about at the State House, the budget. It's the biggest thing the legislature does. At once miraculous, given the number of decisions, and pedestrian, as it is really the basic job of government. This one aims to spend $11.8 billion, so the leanest one proposed thus far. Ali, you've spent the most time of all of us sitting through a good deal of the public negotiations on this plan. What's in and what's out, and what do you think people should know at this point?
Yeah. So, you know, as most people are well aware, Republicans control the House, the Senate, the governor's office for the first time in more than a decade. And I think that this budget really reflects that. There had been some turmoil early on. Some conservatives said they didn't think this budget cut spending by enough. And so this final compromise deal, I think, really goes to the right. Democrats are upset with some more tax cuts for businesses without any triggers like the last round had, just to make sure revenues are coming in strong enough. There are some anti-abortion policies that made their way in, such as barring state dollars from funding abortions, which is a policy that clinics are already following here. And I think those were some of the big areas where Democrats have raised concern. This budget also funds an expansion of mental health beds, which we know has been somewhat of a crisis here in the state. And it also takes aim at some other social services by trying to reform the Child Protection Agency, creating an Office of the Child Advocate to oversee what's going on there. And I think those are some of the major highlights.
You know, Kevin, Republicans have been talking up this budget in the wake of the deal as something that was in keeping with some of Governor Sununu's key goals. As Ali mentioned, there are certainly policies in there Democrats don't like. It wasn't really until the middle of this week that it became clear that the route for this budget was going to be, you know, the natural one, given the partisan makeup of Concord, that it was going to try to appeal to Republicans, including those Republicans who think it spent too much money, the House Freedom Caucus. You know, do you see this as pretty much in keeping with traditional New Hampshire Republican budgets? You know, Ali mentioned the funding for mental health beds, but anything leaping out at you is something new here.
Well, what's interesting about this Republican budget is that clearly you have, as Ali alluded to, you have the leadership of the Republican Party in lockstep behind this thing. Unlike anything I've seen, frankly, in decades. You can recall, Josh, certainly when we had the last Republican governor, Craig Benson, he fought with the Republican legislature at that time. He ended up vetoing the budget because it spent too much money. We haven't had that dynamic at all here. But the membership in the legislature on the Republican side remains very divided. You've got a lot of conservative first and second term conservatives in the House, people who are members of the House Freedom Caucus, and those who aren't, who still think this budget spends too much money. They cut about, I believe it was about $18 million from the budget that passed the state Senate. But certainly in terms of the Republican establishment, there's a lot to like in this budget. And for Governor Chris Sununu, there's a great deal to like. He got not everything he wanted, but almost all the major things he was interested in and laid out in his budget message are somewhere in this document, whether it's kindergarten, infrastructure, mental health, the opioid crisis, on all fronts, he made progress.
I mean, again, but there's still some question as to whether this thing is going to pass.
There absolutely is. I mean, that's what's fascinating about the House this year. They've been confounding conventional wisdom for more than 6 months now, going back to when Sean Jasper barely held on to his speakership during the Republican caucus. That sort of told us this was going to be a raucous ride this year. And it really has been a historic rejection of the House Republican budget by the membership. And now some real suspense about whether enough conservative Republicans are going to go along with this, because clearly all Democrats are not.
And just to provide a little additional context, if we go back to the beginning of the budgetary cycle, you'll remember that this New Hampshire Freedom Caucus, a certain conservative group of legislators modeled on the national group, we're talking about 40 to 60 votes roughly, was able to essentially block any House approval of the budget the first time around, and then it went over to the Senate. And they had asked for several hundred million dollars in unspecified cuts, which the governor was unhappy that they had not sort of been more specific, and as was the House leadership. And so now the second time around, the question is whether or not they're going to be on board. And we had been talking a bit about perhaps Speaker Jasper and the leadership would form some kind of coalition with a number of Democrats in the House to basically bypass the Freedom Caucus. I think the abortion plank in the bill signals that's not likely. The lower revenue estimates, the additional cuts, all of that signals that they're trying to woo this Freedom Caucus. And there's sort of mixed signals about the extent to which the leadership is working that particular group sufficiently to get them on board.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what House Finance Chairman Neil Kirk told me in the wake of this agreement about courting the Freedom Caucus folks?
We've been meeting with a lot of those folks, and this was before this budget was finalized. And talking to them about the budget, what was likely to happen, and I think they are much more open to supporting this budget. I'm optimistic that this budget will pass with Republican support. The things we did are things that Democrats don't like, and the support from Democrats will be much harder to get. Yeah. We didn't get very many votes originally. We'd be lucky to maintain that number of votes from different people.
All right, that was House Finance Chairman Neil Kirk. And you could hear, he says he's confident. He didn't sound so confident, but he also was quite clear that part of the appeal to the conservative critics of the budget process in the House prior was that this contains a lot of stuff Democrats don't like. We talked about the inclusion of the Hyde Amendment, which Democrats really considered to be sort of a thumb in their eye. You know, are there other things in this alley? I mean, the Freedom Caucus folks have been focusing mainly on bottom line general fund dollar amount. And have you heard any wavering from that? I know that's the leader said, well, you know, we've got this abortion stuff in there. We have the tax cuts without triggers. But the Freedom Caucus people really seem to be focused on a bottom line number.
Yeah. I think it's tough to tell because there was more opposition to the budget than just the Freedom Caucus. You know, I think there's probably about three different groups, mm-hmm. which includes the House Republican Alliance, the Freedom Caucus. And it's hard to tell how big the group is and where their allegiances are. And so I think it's tough to tell at this point how each member feels. The only other thing that I've heard beyond the bottom line number from some of the leaders of the House Freedom Caucus is that one wanted funding zeroed out for the university system, which, you know, obviously didn't happen. And another was suggesting that the state eliminate one of the business taxes entirely, which also, you know, is
implausible.
Implausible, exactly. So, I think it remains to be seen. And I think what Republican leaders are trying to do is kind of pick off some people around the edges. And I do think that they said specifically those abortion policies, the business taxes, are meant to try to bring those people into the circle for this budget. I think another thing to note that is new about this budget, at least for me, that stands out, is that it gives a significant amount of money to the governor's office for the first time, which I know that some House members had been kind of opposed to initially. But it would give $10 million to Sununu to hand out scholarships to students, and also would give him about $9 million to start doling out money to school districts for upgrades, for fiber optic cables, and also for safety measures through Homeland Security.
I mean, the scholarship strictures on the scholarship money have been tightened a little bit, but, you know, he still ended up getting a lot of what he wanted there. Why don't we hear from a Democrat on the budget, Lou D'Alessandro, a Senate Finance Committee member, and he, you know, preaches the line that Democrats are saying that essentially the state had more money to spend than it's choosing to spend. Why don't we take a listen?
Well, there's certainly another $40 billion hanging out there, you know, based on the returns. Look at, you look at the revenues over plan so far for this year, and it's, what, $70 million? It was $88 million last year. That's a lot of money over plan. We're in very good economic times. If you shortchange yourself in terms of revenues, then you can't spend money where it should be appropriately spent, where the needs have to be met. To me, that's a disservice to the people of the state of New Hampshire.
That's a longtime Democratic Senator Lou D'Alessandro of Manchester, a member of the Senate Finance Committee, talking about his view, one shared by Democrats, that there was more money to spend, and actually one shared by the governor, if you go back to his revenue estimates. And one tactic Democrats used as this budget was pending in the Senate was to try to get Republicans on board with the governor's revenue estimates. Kevin, the push and pull over revenue estimates is a perennial fight in the budget process.
It is.
You know, where did we end up?
Yeah, and the other thing, of course, is Republicans always have a harder time during good economic times in New Hampshire because their ethic in the legislature very much is to be fiscally conservative and not just spend money we don't have, but not spend all the money because we may need it later. I mean, that's what you often see with this legislature. That's the thing about our budgeting process most people don't understand, which is invariably during the two-year budget cycle, legislature ends up spending sometimes in the tens of millions of dollars in money that wasn't budgeted for things that happen and extra spending that occurs. A good example in this last budget was the Medicaid levels. People remained on Medicaid. Medicaid expansion was so popular that we ended up spending a huge more money than was budgeted for that account. That's one of the reasons why certainly Chuck Morris is somebody who's always, the Senate president, has always been somebody who wants to be conservative with revenue estimates and also likes the idea of requiring agencies to return more unspent money to the Treasury so that it can be used if it's needed.
And just to put some numbers on this, the revenue estimates in the budget in conference is $29 million lower than the Senate estimate. And you mentioned, Josh, the governor, it's $44 million less than the revenue estimates provided by the government. So this is kind of being used as part of the push to get some of these Freedom Caucus members on board.
And in the grand scheme of things, I mean, that amount is tiny when you look at the $11.7 billion budget. But they did have to make some cuts to lawmakers' pet projects to get there, you know, or just what they want to see. Democrats were upset that there wasn't an additional $400,000 to boost prevention for STDs at a time when we're experiencing an outbreak in that area. They ended up cutting money that Governor Sununu had put in to boost funding for New Hampshire legal assistance in the North Country. And those are things that certain lawmakers, you know, really want to see go through. So oftentimes, even though it's a tiny number, what they're cutting has great significance.
And one of the other debates has been over how much money to put for job training. Republicans argue that there are already enough job training programs funded in the budget, and that the way that you grow the workforce is through, you know, tax cuts and private business development and entrepreneurship. You know, Democratic governors have traditionally tended more towards spending on these programs, and Republicans less so. So this has been some of the cuts to that have been part of the discussion as well.
Tell us what you think. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, or email at exchange@nhpr.org, or on social media at NHPRExchange. You know, one issue that's not in the budget expressly, but it's contemplated in the budget is a full-day kindergarten. This proposal's bounced around a good deal in terms of its policy from the beginning, targeted versus kind of grants for every student to funding levels.
Where do we stand now, Allie?
Yeah, so lawmakers reached a deal yesterday that I think was somewhat surprising for people who have watched the legislature for a long time. And basically, they allow funding or more funding for full-day kindergarten, but it will be tied to letting Keno into the state, which is sort of like an electronic lottery game that you can play. It's sort of like bingo mm-hmm. allowed in restaurants. And basically, the deal is predicated on that Keno will raise enough money. If it does raise enough money, then that can fund full-day kindergarten. You know, and in the past, House Republicans have been pretty resistant to expanding full-day kindergarten, whereas the Senate kind of picked it up after Governor Sununu made it a priority.
And the Senate had been loath to contemplate Keno exactly. in favor of a full-bore casino.
Yeah. So it's surprising to see the Senate on board with Keno, which is a policy that they have never liked in the past.
And initially, when Keno was floated as a funding source, it would you know flow into the education trust fund, and it would simply be added to the pile of money in there, or not pile of money in there, and you know it would flow out. And the you know where are we in terms of a per pupil dollar amount? People had wanted $1,800. I think this is at $1,100.
Yeah.
And if there's more revenue available, they may get it. Why don't we take a listen to what Senator David Waters, who was a Democrat from Dover, he was the architect of the original kindergarten bill, which did fully fund it. I think it was the total cost of $24 million and $24.5 million over the biennium. He, like other Democrats, were disappointed by this compromise.
What's unfortunate about the bill today is that it ties it explicitly to Keno. And if Keno doesn't produce enough revenue, then there will be no more than $1,100 available for each student. It leaves families and taxpayers on the hook for kindergarten once again.
All right. That was a Democratic Senator David Waters of Dover talking about the current state of the kindergarten or Keno-garten bill, as some have taken to calling it. You know, Kevin, kindergarten, full-day kindergarten is something that you know, most years Democrats would consider a win in any form.
Right.
You know, what do you expect them to do when push comes to shove to vote for this thing?
Well, Allie and I were talking about this before the program began. This kindergarten program with Keno only passed the House because all Democrats supported it. I mean, Republicans were deeply divided over this full-day kindergarten program, and it wasn't fully funded as it passed through the House, as we've talked about. So, for this to pass, ultimately, a lot of Republicans in the House are no doubt going to have to swallow hard and accept this. I do think Governor Sununu kind of made an appeal to Democrats yesterday, said, you know, this is an important priority we all have. Let's not allow partisan politics to divide us right now. Let's essentially take half a loaf now and maybe get more later. I also believe that this compromise was essentially yet another attempt by the leadership, Republican leadership in the legislature, to appeal to the Freedom Caucus members. Because, again, because it's not a full-day kindergarten, there isn't that greater expense, which makes the budget even bigger. And a lot of Republicans in the House basically looked at this program and said, this is an entitlement that could bust the budget going forward in the future.
Why don't we go to the phones? Peter is on the line from Durham. Good morning, Peter. Go ahead.
Morning. I just have two questions, mostly related to education. But the first one is about school building aid. I know that was cut out of the budget entirely in years past, and it's a big expense that communities are facing. Dover, for instance, is just building a new high school, and other places, their needs exist. Is the state brought any of that back? Does the budget bring any of that back? And the other piece is about the other cost downshifting from the state to communities in terms of retirement costs and in terms of all the other things that after the recession, the state said, well, we can't take this. Let the communities do it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Peter. These are perennial issues on school building aid. Is there anything in there to contemplate that at all, Allie, at this point? I don't believe.
It's sort of complicated. Yeah. There's $2.5 yes. million dollars for school building aid for one project that's in the queue over in Hinsdale. And there's a new system in the governor's office that would give those fiber optic, you know, upgrades or safety upgrades.
Okay, thanks for the call, Peter. Stick around. We'll be right back after a break on the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup.
on the latest Outside In podcast.
I started convulsing or spasming on the ground, and I couldn't even sit up.
What if you could get rescued from anywhere on the planet?
You know, it's like, we're gonna die. Nope, we're gonna make it.
But what happens when not everyone gets the same chance to be saved?
The difficulty obviously rises when affluence gives one person a better chance of survival than another person.
Download Outside In on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Kevin Landrigan, the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor. We'll see where kindergarten ends up. One thing that is not in any doubt this year is that we're not going to have changes aimed at addressing the problems of PFC-tainted water. There was a bill under negotiation that would have allowed state regulators to lower the health advisory for chemicals based on new science and standards that other states were adopting. This bill had no problem in the Senate, but the House ended up refusing to go there. Why is that?
Well, essentially, the House felt that the Department of Environmental Services was doing an adequate job of managing the federal standard for PFOAs and did not want to impose an additional burden that they felt would actually end up increasing local spending at the local level of trying to monitor these levels. That I think it's, you know, Josh, and we see this in every legislative session. There's always a bill or two that appears to be have universal support and even bipartisan support that ends up kind of falling through the cracks. And this is this year's edition. I did not expect this to happen. I thought ultimately enough conservatives in the House would go along with this, but they didn't.
We have an email in from Marjorie Smith, who sits on the House Finance Committee. She points out that we've neglected to mention that to make the bottom line seem smaller than it is, the budget plans to have $300 million go through the 10-member fiscal committee. Having spending go through fiscal that might be contemplated in the budget is a time-tested approach. I'm in no position to verify Representative Smith's number at this point, but does that sound plausible to you, Allie?
Yeah. One of the ways is to get that money out, send it through fiscal. That way it doesn't appear in the bottom line number.
Right.
The fiscal committee, as she did say, it's a 10-member committee of pretty high-ranking House members and senators. Yeah.
And also, this is a big bugaboo from Myra Smith. When she was chairman of the House Finance Committee, she kind of led an effort to make the budget more transparent and required all the grants to be counted in the bottom line, which if you count everything in the budget, that's why this thing comes up to almost $12 billion when you count all grants and all expenses into this budget. It's a huge document.
It'll be interesting to see how those sorts of accounting choices will be scrutinized by conservative critics of the budget who, again, want to have a clear grip on precisely the number of dollars spent in this plan. But we'll certainly be stay tuned for that debate next week. It's also true that while this PFC bill failed in somewhat of a surprise, not all was impasse this week. The governor did sign House Bill 400, which aims to address mental health system and New Hampshire Child Protection Agency. Allie, you've covered this a good deal. How significant is this change in law?
It is significant, but I will say that, most of the major reforms in what's known as House Bill 400 was the money, and that's all been moved into the budget, which is an expansion of mental health beds across the state to try to alleviate those wait lists for getting into New Hampshire Hospital. Patients have sort of languished in emergency rooms for days or weeks trying to get access to treatment. And so that expansion tries to deal with that. It would also add an Office of the Child Advocate to oversee DCYF. As I said, that funding is in the budget. So this bill that Governor Sununu signed would call on the state to create a plan for children in the mental health system, would make some changes at DCYF in how they label reports of abuse and neglect. But most of the substantial changes, as I believe Governor Sununu mentioned, is the spending that's part of the budget. So if that passes, then, you know, this bill will have a much greater effect than if the budget goes down and that spending can't be realized.
This particular issue, it always comes down to the amount of resources that are going to be spent. The bill talks about coming up with a 10-year reform plan, which is all well and good. We have other multi-year plans in the past, but inevitably the hitch is always how much money is going to be spent. And there's been a debate. You know, I think Governor Sununu has certainly talked a lot about this issue. He's given it a lot of visibility. He's kind of adopted it as an important part of his agenda. But, you know, the argument with Democrats is always going to be over, you know, how much money is actually being spent on creating hospital beds and creating opportunities and communities for people to get care, et cetera. So, you know, we'll continue to watch it. But this is at least a step in that direction.
We know that signing ceremony was only part of Governor Sununu's week. He also spent some time in Washington meeting with cabinet officials. What was going on there, Dean?
He went down to Washington and met with a number of cabinet officials. He met with Elaine Chao from Transportation and Betsy DeVos of Education, Linda McMahon, Small Business Administration. He stopped in at the FCC and also the EPA. And it's interesting. He essentially, you know, depending on the particular agency, talked about issues like, infrastructure with transportation and charter schools at education and net-related issues at the FCC, et cetera. So just basically an opportunity to kind of get into the bureaucracy and sort of push for sort of particular New Hampshire-related outcomes.
And while he was there, he also called to keep reporters abreast of some of what he did there. He also kind of got something off his chest about his feelings about the New Hampshire's congressional delegation. Why don't we take a listen to that?
These types of trips are absolutely necessary. Right now, our federal delegation does a very poor job advocating for what our state needs. The administration is not listening to them. The administration, the only thing the administration hears from them is all the negativity that our federal delegation pushes. That is never going to get you a seat at the table and is never going to get good results for the state of New Hampshire.
Okay, that was the governor weighing in on his view of the way our all-Democratic delegation has been acting in Washington. Kevin, we're in a situation where we have all-Democrats in Washington, Republican governor. I don't think we've ever had that before. How did this critique strike you?
Well, it was certainly very strongly worded by this governor and unusual. Governors certainly want to have a good relationship with the congressional delegation because whether they're of your party or not, you need them in Washington. They are your advocates for the state in Washington, whether ideologically you're in lockstep or not. 90% of what a governor of New Hampshire wants out of Washington, usually members of the delegation will support. So keeping good relations is really important. And I think this speaks to how little communication there has clearly been between this Republican governor and this Democratic congressional delegation. The other thing, frankly, it speaks to that I was hearing prior to these comments this week is that of the Trump administration's desire for the Republicans in New Hampshire to be more vocal in support of him. I heard this prior to Kellyanne Conway's trip to New Hampshire, that there was a belief that New Hampshire Republicans weren't doing enough to basically trump up the Trump agenda in New Hampshire. And we've certainly seen Republican Chairman Jeanne Forrester be very vocal in supporting Trump in recent weeks, and we certainly see this governor doing the same.
Well, there was a GOP-hosted Donald Trump birthday party this week,
exactly,
among other things.
Yep.
But certainly the governor has gone out of his way to at least appear open to sort of anything that comes out of the Trump administration at first blush. I mean, sometimes he steps away from that, and maybe that's natural if you're a Republican governor and you share the party with your president. But, you know, Allie, what do you make of this?
Well, I think, I guess for me it's important to note that I think the delegation kind of took the first shots last week when they were all very highly critical of Governor Sununu's decision not to join this U.S. Climate Alliance, which kind of comes in response to President Trump's pulling out of the Paris Agreement. And so they had some very strong words about his decision. And to me, I kind of saw this as him kind of fighting back on that front. But I'm wondering, I guess, going forward, if this fissure is going to continue and maybe cause problems among them going forward.
Yeah, I did a sit-down interview with Governor Sununu yesterday, and you can find a link to the audio at my website, nhpoliticalcapital.com, and we talked about both of these issues. And first, on the criticism of the congressional delegation, I laid out the alternative argument to him that you have a president who has called Democratic leadership in Congress losers, who's called the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer the chief clown. Republicans have shut Democrats out of the process of reforming health care. And so I essentially asked, Governor Sununu was complaining about their negativity. I asked him, what would you have them do? And to me, he seemed to sort of back away a little bit of the sort of wholesale criticism and focus more on the issue of, wanting the delegation to kind of get more into the weeds in the bureaucracy to push for some of these outcomes for New Hampshire. That's my characterization. You can listen to the audio and decide for yourself. On the climate agreement, his argument was that, he's an environmental engineer. New Hampshire's stewardship of the environment is quite strong, much stronger than he mentioned governors of Governor Brown in California and Governor Cuomo in New York who have signed on. He says he doesn't need to do that. He was quite forceful on that he has no interest in sort of doing what some of these other states are doing. But I encourage you to listen to the audio and you can hear him address both of these issues.
Someone who was also being fairly forceful this week in Washington was Senator Jeanne Shaheen. She was in hearings involving the Trump Justice Department. She was pressing Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein about whether or not Special Counsel Robert Mueller was in any jeopardy of being fired and that he would have independence. Why don't we take a listen to this back and forth?
Now, as I understand, Mr. Rosenstein, in this matter, you are actually the one exercising hiring and firing authority because Attorney General Sessions is recused. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And at this point, have you seen any evidence of good cause for firing of Special Counsel Mueller?
No, I have not.
And have you given the Special Counsel full independence from the Justice Department to conduct his investigation?
Yes, Senator, and I appreciate that question.
All right. We cut off Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein there because he went on a very technical explanation. But his bottom line is that he has confidence that Special Counsel Mueller will have independence. That's an open question given some of the reporting out of Washington. Jeanne Shaheen, meanwhile, has been aggressive throughout, really early on in pursuing information about Russian meddling in the fall election, and certainly showing no signs of slowing down, Kevin.
Not at all, no. And also at the end of the week, very prominent in the debate over stiffening sanctions against Russia as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We're certainly seeing from Jeanne Shaheen what we often see from someone who's in the middle of a Senate term become not more partisan, but more vocal, more active. And as that's generally collegially the way the Senate operates. So that, for example, Democrats who happen to be up in 2018 election will be less vocal than you would typically see them be after they get elected. So she's got a lot of freedom to take some of these fights to Trump and is doing so.
It's obviously a heated atmosphere in Washington these days. And, we have a new name of somebody who wants to get in the fray down there. And that would be First District candidate now, currently Bedford State Senator Andy Sanborn. History has shown Republicans can win the first congressional district seat. And can't say anyone was too surprised that he's thrown his hat in the ring. It's kind of early, though, isn't it, Dean? I mean, Eddie Edwards is in the race, but we're talking, close to 2 years out.
Yeah, it is amazing to me, just in general, having covered politics in the state for over 20 years now, just the way that the electoral cycles keep expanding and expanding and expanding. The presidential race is essentially a 4-year race now rather than a 18-month or 2-year race. And these statewide or congressional district elections, typically you would expect people to start jumping in, you know, sort of the fall, maybe on into the winter, give yourself a good year plus. This does, you know, it's a little bit early, but in the current context and the emphasis on money and fundraising and how expensive these races are getting now, you know, we're talking millions of dollars just to run for a House seat now, and the need to bring in outside dollars, as we're seeing in some of the special elections around the country, these congressional races, we've seen tremendous amounts of outside money. So there is something to be said for getting up and running early, and we've expected, there's been a lot of discussion that Mr. Sanborn was going to get in. And there, I think there are, you know, at least one or two other candidates for that Republican primary as well. But as you mentioned, Josh, this seat does have a tendency to kind of swing back and forth. And, you know, one indicator down the road will be the extent to which the congressional committees, campaign committees pump money into the district for the race.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. Right now, the primary is Eddie Edwards, former chief of liquor enforcement, Andy Sanborn, who has been in the state Senate representing two different districts. He owns the Draft Sports Bar in Concord, has other business entities he's involved with. You know, one thing that's interesting about the primary as it stands now is, you know, one backstory I've heard from the senator explain as to why he got into politics. In his opening video, he cast himself as very much, you know, regular guy, call me Andy. He kept on saying, no one can run to the right, but I can outperform the top of the ticket, et cetera. He talked about his getting into politics as being partially motivated by the heavy hand of the Liquor Commission Enforcement Division. I've also heard him mention the LLC tax as another reason he got into politics. Right. But, you know, it's worth noting that the Enforcement Division was led by Eddie Edwards. So there's kind of a personal angle here from the outset, which is going to be interesting to watch regardless of who gets in.
Yeah, I think that's true. I also think, you know, Eddie Edwards has Mike Biondo helping his campaign, a prominent Republican operative who played a lead role in the Trump campaign in New Hampshire. And Edwards has managed to get a number of people to endorse him early on. I think his campaign got off to a quicker start, frankly, than some of his potential opponents expected. I do think that's another reason why Sanborn decided no better time than the present for as this legislative session comes to a close for me to jump in and spend the summer trying to raise that money Dean talked about.
You know, smaller race, also closely watched, is underway, and that's in a swing state Senate district. That's District 16, a special election pitting Republican David Booten, who, of course, held the seat before against Democrat Kevin Kavanaugh. You know, voting is going to take place in that race July 25th, so it is kind of creeping up on us. And, you know, this is something that, you know, fairly or not, people are going to see as some sort of bellwether for things to come. This weekend, Gene Shaheen is going to be launching a canvassing rally for Kavanaugh. Republicans definitely want Booten back in there. You know, how much of a test is this for the GOP under new chair Jeanne Forrester?
It is a big test, I mean, in my view, and here's why. Dave Booten was an accomplished state senator, but not always a conservative Republican state senator. He supported Medicaid expansion, a number of other issues that upset conservatives. And the concern on the Republican leadership of this state is, will there be enough energy and momentum behind Booten, particularly from the right wing of the party? And in a special election in July, that enthusiasm is extremely important because you have to literally drag people to the polls in late July to get them to vote on a single election for the state Senate. Conversely, on the Democratic side, a lot of enthusiasm for Kevin Kavanaugh, a new fresh face in Manchester, a ward alderman who's been there a couple of years, but
we had a big win in the primary.
Very big win.
Over somebody, you know, Jim Norman, obviously not active too much lately,
right,
but somebody who's won races before, and that was kind of a rout for Kavanaugh.
It was, and also somebody for more than almost 30 years now has been a fixture in unions in Manchester, which, as you know, Josh and Allie, is very important constituency, and particularly an important one in a special election. These people turn out voters, and they will turn out voters for Kevin Kavanaugh in July.
I mean, it doesn't seem to be a coincidence that you know, this is the second Democrat that's been put up in this district with a strong union background.
Right.
Prior, Scott McGilvery, who died in office, of course, was top official with the NEA, and that certainly helps motivate people, particularly in the depths of the summer.
I will say what has been interesting to me in this race is that Dave Booten, who, you know, obviously held this seat for, I think, about 6 years before he decided not to run again and is now running in a special election, he did get the endorsement from the State Employees Association, which is the largest union of state workers. And so I think that is interesting when you have him running against a union organizer. You know, the union that represents the state is backing him. So it could be kind of an interesting dynamic.
Agreed. Join us. Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. We've got much more to talk about, and I promise we'll get out of the State House shortly. Stick around. More after the break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, do join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. As I mentioned, as we came into the break, not everything is at the State House or elective politics. There were also regulatory hearings underway in the state that have a political moment, certainly, on the Northern Pass Project. This week, after days of fairly technical, often lawyerly back and forth from the state's Site Evaluation Commission and witnesses and lawyers, the public got a chance to weigh in. The difference in tone is remarkable. And why don't we just start off by taking a listen to what Meredith Briggs of Deerfield said yesterday.
I want you to know, and I want you to understand, I would cut out my tongue and dig out my heart with a spoon before I would come to any conclusions I believe would be injurious to the town I love so much. Deerfield is my past, Deerfield is my present, and Deerfield is my future.
Okay, that was Meredith Briggs of Deerfield, a supporter of the Northern Pass Project, kind of going at a kind of Dante Alighieri style in terms of the rhetoric there about digging out one's heart with a spoon. Dean, obviously, the role of the Site Evaluation Commission committee is to evaluate adverse impacts. You know, a lot of strong feelings remain in this project.
Yeah, and that has been the case all along. And, you know, as the Northern Pass group has tried to kind of adapt the project a little bit and attempt to appease some of the opposition, I don't know that they've been tremendously successful in doing that. The piece of sound we heard was from an individual who lives in Deerfield. Deerfield, which is where the project terminates, I believe, and she was supporting it for jobs. But this hearing the other day was the first, I think there are several more this summer, for public input, and the vast majority of people who spoke either complained about the aesthetics and the damage to tourism and the environment, or they argued that, you know, given the impact on the land, some people refer to it as scarring of the land, that there's not enough direct benefit for New Hampshire, that, you know, there may be a little bit of side benefit off of this power, but it's really mainly for other parts of New England. So there's still a lot of opposition. This has been going on a long time, and so perhaps something like about 9 years, I think, or something like that, 7 to 9 years, this has been in the work. So I think, you know, people, as the project moves along, people continue to oppose it, and you can hear the emotion in a lot of the comments.
Well, I've talking to lawyers involved kind of on both sides of this, and I was asking them where they thought this was going. And, you know, when they're being honest, they say they don't really know. Obviously, you can sit in these hearings and hear a real criticism of the project and people, holes being punched in it by lawyers. But obviously, Eversource, they know how to do these things. It's hard to know where this is going. The political noise around this, continues to be loud. I guess we'll stay tuned. We're supposed to learn at the end of the summer.
Yeah. And I will say this played a big role yesterday in the hearing for Bob Scott, who's up for Sununu's second choice now to head the Department of Environmental Services. Northern Pass critics are watching this post because the head of DES has a seat on the committee that will yay or nay the project.
And Bob Scott has served as a public utilities commissioner as well, so he's...
He already does have a seat at the committee, but he has recused himself from the Northern Pass process, and he said, if confirmed as DES head, he would continue to do that. Although two of the Republican councilors there yesterday were pretty frustrated. They kept trying to ask him what his position was on Northern Pass. He wouldn't really answer directly, and that was causing some frustration for them at the hearing.
Well, I was in the room during some of that, and it was interesting. You know, he basically said, you know, I don't have enough information to know. He said, I think the term he used was holistically, I might be in favor of importing something on the energy front from Canada, but I don't have the information to say whether Northern Pass is the best way to do that.
Yeah, certainly. And this this does remain, it's such a long debated project, and we're actually approaching a point where there's going to be a decision made on this, and which is somewhat amazing. In some ways, I wondered whether this ever was going to come to pass, but it obviously will. And I think what really complicates this is the full-blown debate over whether this energy is really needed in New England, whether this much energy is essential to add to the grid. There's a lot of disagreement about that, as well as disagreement about the aesthetics and of high transmission lines and the dangers they could potentially pose.
Well, listening to Bob Scott during the hearing yesterday, there was also a lot of talk. They were asked about the issues that you deemed to be most important on the environmental front. And, you know, one he talked about was energy efficiency and, you know, the debate over whether there needs to be more generation or greater efficiency can offset that, you know, continues. And we obviously have competing projects that may, you know, imperil Northern Pass, you know, other projects coming out of Canada. You know, we'll see. And we'll also see what happens with Bob Scott. I mean, Ali, did you get the sense that it was clear that he has the votes to win confirmation at this point?
So both Democrats, so the executive council will sign off. There's five members controlled by Republicans. The two Democrats said they were inclined to support him. He worked at DES for about almost two decades before joining the PUC. However, the two Republicans who were there, Councillor Russell Prescott was not at the hearing. The two Republicans I talked to afterwards said, you know, they were undecided. They were waiting for more information, but they were not, didn't seem super pleased by the hearing's result, especially in regard to the Northern Pass questions.
I mean, as far as Bob Scott goes, it was an interesting choice in that certainly a strong background and in knowing how the DES works and knowing the players he'd be dealing with, a real departure from Sununu's first pick, Peter Kujawski, former business executive who you know, kind of alarmed some of the council members, I think, by some of his responses during the hearing, and you know, his nomination was pulled. You know, we're going to have a vote on Bob Scott soon. And you mentioned Russ Prescott wasn't there. Apparently, he was recovering from surgery, but had a lengthy one-on-one interview with Bob Scott, was the announcement made at the hearing. You know, another hearing coming up is going to be for Governor Sununu's first pick to fill a vacancy on the state's highest court. Bobby Hantz, Marconi, you know, well-known lawyer, was at one time quite active in Republican politics, and now works at the Sheehan Finney firm in Manchester. Her hearing's going to be on Monday. You know, Kevin, do you have a sense of how her nomination is being greeted?
Well, she's certainly well-regarded as an attorney for many years, and as you point out, Sheehan Finney is a really respected firm, one of the largest firms, and one of the most politically active firms in the state, frankly. You're right that her start really before the law began in politics. She actually was a staff head at the Republican State Committee when John H. Sununu was governor. She worked for John Stabile, who at the time was the chairman of the Republican Party, and went to law school and, as I say, developed a really accomplished career as a civil and corporate lawyer. So I expect her to be confirmed. I really do. I think there was some, certainly in, there were some in the legal community who were a little surprised by the pick in that very often we see Carol Ann Conboy is retiring and folks expected this governor to nominate a woman to replace Carol Ann Conboy. But there are women on the Superior Court who have a lot of experience and Tina Nato, certainly, who was a choice, and Chief Justice of the Superior Court, someone who was a pick of a Republican governor, Steve Merrill, to first be on the court. Jillian Abramson is another accomplished woman judge in the Superior Court. So for Sununu to step outside the judicial branch and pick somebody new, that was unique, and it certainly surprised some folks, but she is a logical pick for him to
Well, another wrinkle to this, and I wrote a little story about this, was that she was initially tapped by the governor to be on his Judicial Selection Commission, and until the day she applied to be on the bench, she was a member of that commission. Apparently, she didn't participate in deliberations, certainly for the Supreme Court position, according to people on the commission. But it's interesting because the Judicial Selection Commission was created by executive order. Bobby Hans had served on a Judicial Selection Commission put together by Governor Lynch, and on the predecessor commissions, both those of Governor Shaheen, Lynch, and Hassan, you couldn't be a commission member and then be eligible for judicial appointment until at least a year after you left the commission. That stipulation was not included in the commission that Governor Sununu put together. And so, you know, the Hans nomination can go forward. But he told me he made a conscious decision not to include that requirement because he said that he didn't want to keep the best candidates from coming forward, even if they had been part of the Judicial Selection Commission. In any case, her hearing will be Monday, and it'll be interesting to see what more we learn there. I also want to turn to some reporting out of the newsroom at NHPR, a story that Paige Sutherland, who's out of town, otherwise she might be here to talk about, did about some complaints against Hope for New Hampshire Recovery, which is a network of peer recovery centers. They've got several of them in New Hampshire. Essentially, she spoke with former employees there who alleged harassment, inflation of treatment numbers, turning a blind eye to some drug dealing. That reporting and those complaints have led the Attorney General's office to look into it. You know, Hope for New Hampshire Recovery is disputing some of the claims made by these former employees, who they note some of them were fired. You know, Kevin, this outfit grew fast. It had political connections, and had a lot going on all at once. What do you make of this?
Yeah, it did. I think that's one thing the Page story really, I think, pretty well points out, that this is a group that essentially grew faster than it was able to grow, and as a result, has had growing pains and had problems at the agency. And even in the statements that Hope for New Hampshire Recovery put out, responding to the story after the fact, by the way, which incidentally is never a good idea. When somebody's reporting, doing an investigative report on your agency, don't refuse to comment, which serially happened in this case. Paige made several attempts to talk to people, and they wouldn't talk to her. But after the story, even they acknowledged, we haven't done things that are perfect. Yes, we employ people often who are former addicts, because that's the ethic of our agency, is to give these folks another chance. And some of them have fallen off the wagon, and that's unfortunate. But one thing that was interesting about this, their response too, was the suggestion essentially that all of this is coming up because essentially rival agencies don't like the fact that Hope for New Hampshire Recovery is getting all this money and expanding in this way and trying to take them down a peg, which you generally don't see in the nonprofit healthcare community, this kind of infighting that is obviously going on.
And this was held as a potential success story, the expansion, right, the opening of the new headquarters in Manchester. We have a facility that opened here in Concord, in the South End. Reading Paige's reporting, you know, one of the more disturbing accusations is this idea that they accelerated certification of peer counselors. You have to have 500 hours, and they were basically being signed off on with very little training in order to qualify for insurance dollars. And I think if that turns out to be true, that's a very concerning aspect of this. But it just sort of sounds like they expanded too quickly and were not prepared for the level of demand as a result of the opioid crisis.
Well, if you look at the story, I mean, obviously the state has an opioid crisis. There's a need for services to people who are seeking to be in recovery. Certainly peer recovery, to the extent that I've covered this, and it's been pretty minor, but, you know, you hear very strenuous statements from people in the business that kind of nobody knows better how to recover than somebody in recovery. And, you know, there may be some truth to that, but, you know, there have been questions about you know, the efficacy of peer recovery and, you know, at what point, you know, public dollars should be invested in it. And, you know, Governor Sununu and Attorney General McDonald said that, you know, it's worth looking into. We'll see where this goes next. Before we end up here, I want to mention that we can't escape the bears this summer. there was dumpster diving at Bike Week. A story in your paper this morning, Kevin, about Richard Whitney, you know, best known as a portrait artist of business leaders, many governors. He recently did Governor Benson's portrait, which is recently unveiled but yet to be hung. He's cited for improper bear feeding at Stoddard and not a first offense.
No, it wasn't. 3 years ago, he also pled guilty to feeding them improperly. And this brings up this kind of philosophical debate about feeding bears. Whitney and people who think like him believe that diversionary feeding of bears is actually not only humane, but it reduces the amount of nuisance complaints. That if he referred to a person that we interviewed, my colleague Pat Grossmith interviewed out in Minnesota, who spent 50 years in the study of bear psychology, essentially. And this notion is that you can essentially create feeding stations of bears. And in some states, this has happened. And folks like Whitney basically say New Hampshire's missing a tourism opportunity with both moose and bears, that we've seen with moose, certainly with ticks, the population decrease. It's harder to find them. And with bears, they're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. Yet Whitney argues and his folks argue that if you create these feeding areas and you feed them properly, they won't then do dumpster diving all over the neighborhood. A lot of neighbors around Stoddard don't feel comforted by that. And they complain to Fish and Game that we can't even go to the lake without trying to dodge bears to get to the water. So that's why he's been charged.
I mean, people do. I've learned in the past few weeks that people have very strong feelings
about this issue.
And, you know, it is interesting. Right now, if you walk into Governor Sununu's office, there's a stuffed bear on his desk that somebody said, thank you. You know, there's Craig Benson's yet-to-be-hung portrait, you know, 3 feet away from this bear. I never would have thought that these issues would have had a common thread, but apparently they do. So enough of the bears for now. Next week, obviously, we've got to see what happens with the budget. I'm assuming that's going to be, you know, getting the bear share of your attention. Allie, anything else on your mind about next week?
That'll be primarily the focus, and as we talked about, the hearing for Sununu's Supreme Court pick.
Kevin, what are you going to be up to?
I'm actually working on a story concerning an area of consumer fraud that's really alarming. When you buy and sell a house, you got to be very careful about basically wiring money at closing. It's become a real target for hackers.
Dean?
All about the budget, watching the dance between the Republican leadership and the Freedom Caucus and seeing what happens.
All right. I'm going to be keeping my eye on that as well. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. Thank you to my guest, Dean Spiliotis, Kevin Landrigan, and Allie Morris. Thank you for joining us. Hope everyone has a pleasant weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.